This is The World Cafe. My name is Raina Duras. Today, I'm so excited to be joined by Rick Steves. Rick Steves, welcome to The World Cafe.
Hey, it's nice to be with you, Raina. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Your latest book is called For the Love of Europe, My Favorite Places, People, and Stories. And it's 100 of your favorite memories in one book. It's been really, really nice to be able to read this, especially this year when we haven't been able to travel. Usually, you're writing guidebooks to guide other people on their travels. This time, it's your own personal experiences. First of all, if you had to guess, maybe you know, how many times have you actually been to Europe in your life?
Well, I've never really counted, but it's pretty easy to keep track of it because it's been every year, except for this last year, since I was 18 years old, when I graduated from high school in 1973. And I used to be a piano teacher, and kids wouldn't practice in the summer. So I thought, this is frustrating. I'm not going to spin my wheels here. I'm going to Europe, and I'll see you in September, and then we'll hit it. So I would go every summer. I would take off, and I would travel, just slumming around Europe on a piano teacher's income, you know, and I'd get home and I'd work and I'd scrimp and save and I'd go again the next year. And after many trips, it occurred to me, I'm learning from my mistakes. I'm becoming a pretty good traveler. And I had to decide, am I going to be a piano teacher or am I going to be a travel writer? I had a recital hall. I had 50 piano students and I had a couple of teachers working with me and we had a recital hall here in Edmonds, north of Seattle. And slowly I started using my recital hall as a little personal travel lecture hall. And I had, you know, parents at the recital, the Christmas recital or the spring recital, sitting on boxes of my first edition of Europe Through the Back Door. They were lined up against the back wall. I mean, it occurred to me, I got to choose one or the other. Am I a piano teacher or am I a travel teacher? And ultimately, I became a travel teacher, but I sure love my memories of teaching piano and I treasure my piano to this day.
I want to get into your piano a little bit later on, but let's focus on the travel stuff first.
Yep.
You've kept journals about traveling your whole life. Where do you even begin when it comes to narrowing it down to just 100 stories for a book?
Well, that was a very exciting thing I've been wanting to do forever. My first book, Europe Through the Back Door, 1980, which I've updated every year since, originally was kind of two books in one. The first half was the skills and the left half was articles on my favorite discoveries, what I called the back doors. And over time, the skills became the focus of the book and I kind of retired the back doors, but I always wanted to resurrect that collection of my favorite articles. And during last year, I kind of locked myself down, or 2019 before COVID hit, without even knowing we'd be locked down. I locked myself down earlier and I wrote this book. And then the next year I realized, oh, I could have written it during this lockdown, but it was kind of a opportune thing because I had written it. And this is the perfect book for travelers to keep their travel dreams alive, is just to page through 400 pages of my favorite travel experiences. But you mentioned I'm just sort of wired to write guidebooks. And the challenge for me on this was to sweep through and cull out all of the practical travel tips, you know, that goes in a guidebook. And I just wanted the magic and the atmosphere and the inspiration of all the great experiences you have on the road. So it was really fun to comb out the practical, oh, remember it's closed on Tuesday, so it's really crowded on Monday and Wednesday, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And just talk about the subtitle of the book is My Favorite Places, People, and Stories. So it's really just a collection of my 100 favorite essays. And I had an opportunity to read it out loud in a recording studio for the audiobook. And I thought it was going to be an exhausting, grueling experience, but I got so into just reading it out loud and reliving all those memories. It was a delightful week of reading the book, you know, so I'm really thankful to have those memories and to be able to share them with this new book, For the Love of Europe.
Well, like you said, I mean, it is kind of the perfect book for right now. You talk about things you've seen, you've done, food you've eaten, and you do talk about music. And since we are a music show and we can't travel in real life right now, today we're going to kind of take a musical tour of Europe with you. Let's make our first stop. Let's say we're getting off the plane. We'll start where your book starts, in Portugal and Spain. And the first place you take us is to this little restaurant in the seaside city of Lisbon, Portugal. You go into this tiny place, enjoy some sardines and some music. What kind of music might you hear performed in one of those tiny bars or restaurants?
Oh, in Portugal, it's fado. And fado is kind of like seems to me it's sort of the the fisherwoman's, the widowed fisherwoman's blues. You know, her man sailed away and he never came back. And the saltiness of her tears is mirrored in the saltiness of the waves that lap against her little cottage. And you go to these humble little hole-in-the-wall restaurants. And there's a couple of people sitting on a stool with their mandolins and their Portuguese guitars. And there's usually an older woman, just pouring out her emotions in this music. And everybody's just eating sardines and in the moment. And you can see the cooks. I'm envisioning it right now, Raina. I'm looking at the cooks in the far end of the hall. And they're sticking their head through the little hole where they pass the dishes, and you can see them, they're kind of backlit and there's steam and everything, and they're caught up in the music. And then this old woman gets eye contact with you, and you decide not to look away. You just look right at her, and she just drills you with her eyes and her music and her voice and the mandolin. And then you have a sardine and another glass of wine. And those are the kind of magic moments that anybody can have. What's it cost? It just costs a plate of sardines. And you just got to be out late at night in the rustic part of town, and you're making the fado scene.
Yeah, and you have this picture of her in the book too, of one of the women who's singing, and she's wearing this sort of like black tasseled mourning dress. Like, it's very intense. I could imagine
with a plunging neckline, and it's just sort of confusing because she's she's sexy, she's old, she's mourning. You're a gawky tourist. It's just a beautiful moment, and it's just, you want to go out the next night and go to another one of these fado bars. And I just love to be struck emotionally by the music. You know, I'm a pretty casual music listener, but you don't need to be a sophisticate. You just got to open up your heart and be romantic and nostalgic about it and put yourself in a situation where it's not crass tourism, but it's actually culture by and for the local people. And you're right there and you're part of the scene.
Well, let's do that right now. Let's listen to some Portuguese fado music. If you listen really close, you can almost smell the ocean. This is World Cafe.
De cá entre mel, matentação do céu e desencanto, eis o que o céu me deu. Serei bem eu sob este véu de pranto, sem saber.
So that was some Portuguese fado music. You are listening to World Cafe. I'm Raina Duras. Today, we're going on a musical tour of Europe with my guest, Rick Steves, visiting some of the places he talks about in his latest book, For the Love of Europe. You just heard fado music, folk music from Portugal. We're going to hit the road now and head to the Spanish region of Andalusia. Am I saying Andalusia right?
I think you'd say Andalusia.
Andalusia.
But there's different ways, Raina, to say, you know, I wouldn't get too hung up on it, because is it correct to say Paris or Paris, Seville or Sevilla? So,
right. You
know, you just kind of go with what feels comfortable for you, and people are just happy that you're trying to speak the language.
How would you describe Andalusia as a place?
Andalusia is the southern part of Spain, and it really is, it's kind of like the southern part of Germany. When you think of Germany, you think of Bavaria, Lederhosen and beer halls and clinking big mugs of beer and this kind of checkered tablecloths. And that's, I think, more Bavarian than German, but we think of it as German. Same thing in Spain. When you think of Spain, I think you're thinking of Andalusia. And Andalusia is whitewashed villages. It's the flamenco soul. There's a word in flamenco, duenda, I think it's called, where it's just the soul. And it goes back to the Moorish heritage. The Moors were the Muslim hordes that came in from Africa over the Strait of Gibraltar in 711. And for seven centuries, they ruled Andalusia. And a very sophisticated culture. When Europe was in the Dark Ages, Andalusia had, Cordoba was one of the most sophisticated cities on the planet. And it was Moorish and Muslim. And you've got this haunting echo of the Moorish world in today's flamenco. And it comes with riveting dancing and sangria wine. I love how music is kind of flirting and sexy and so on. And it's just, there's this language, this parallel language in music from culture to culture. And it is, it's all wrapped up in romance and you know, just embracing life. And of course, when you go to Spain, when you go to Andalusia, there's touristy flamenco shows that are kind of crass. And there are really quality flamenco shows. The best flamenco acts you're going to see in Madrid, which is not in Andalusia, but that's where the big crowds and the big money is. So if you want to see the top acts, be sure to take advantage of that when you're in Madrid. And then, of course, Sevilla. Seville is the kind of the capital of Andalusia. And that's where you've got a lot of tourism and a lot of competition with wonderful shows. When I'm traveling, I'm not really likely to be out after midnight. If you want the real hardcore flamenco, you want to be out after midnight and you just follow your ears if you hear it. And for the cost of a jug of sangria wine, you're there participating and enjoying it. But I find that the tourist shows, you know, after dinner in the evening are just wonderful. And some of them are put on for tour groups and they're kind of schmaltzy. Others are put on by organizations dedicated, whose mission is to keep the flamenco culture vibrant and alive. And they really are evangelical about their art. And they sit you down and you get a serious education. So there's plenty of opportunities to enjoy good flamenco.
In your book, the chapter in Andalusia, it's called Hair Trigger Flamenco. Oh, yeah. In Andalusia. What do you mean by hair trigger?
Oh, I love societies that are just already always cocked and loaded to have a party, you know. And that was the story. I was in Cordoba, the wonderful city I was referring to that was so sophisticated 1,000 years ago during the Moorish time. And we were at a dinner, filming a wonderful dinner. And then I had to go back to my hotel to get a sweater. And I found a festival in a square. And I just wanted to be there filming. But we were filming this wonderful thing in the restaurant, so we couldn't be two places at once. And then we were heading home later, and everybody was just kind of exhausted. And most people had gotten home. And this is the festival of the Red Rose Cross or something like that. So they had all these crosses made out of red roses. And I thought, everybody's just wasted and exhausted. But I walked up there and I just asked them something like, shall we dance? And it was just like, bam, their castanets were going and people were doing their sultry kind of movements and the guitars and the olés. And it was a hair trigger moment. I just suggested it. And it was like tipping over a bunch of dominoes. This is bam, bam, bam. Everybody's no longer leaning on the bar. They're out there dancing. And I just got to join them. And then the camera was on me. And I was back at the bar afterwards. And I remember slamming down this this shot of whatever fire water they were drinking. and then I had this, I slammed it down. And I normally don't do that because I got to remember my lines. But
right.
we're on the way home here and we're just having fun. So I slammed it down. And there was this, everybody's looking at me. And there's this wonderful silence, and then I just go, ole! And the whole place went, ole! And it was such a hair trigger flamenco moment. And I just thought, I love to be out on the streets in Europe, ready to enjoy the musical moment.
Oh, that's so fun. I'm speaking with Rick Steves. Today, it really does feel like the World Cafe because we are traveling the world. We're traveling Europe with Rick Steves today. He's my guest, sharing some musical stories from his latest book, For the Love of Europe. But I want to go back just a little bit. Maybe, Rick, could you tell us about your first trip to Europe?
My first trip to Europe was a surprise. I remember I came from school one day when I was 14 years old and my dad said, son, we're going to Europe to see the piano factories. And I thought, Dad, that is a stupid idea. But I didn't speak the language. I wanted to be home in the summer with my friends.
Where was that first piano? Where was the piano factory?
Well, my dad was a piano tuner in Seattle. And then he started importing pianos. And he imported the very best pianos made in the whole world and from Germany and from Austria. So we went over there to the factories. And on about day two, it occurred to me, this is really cool. I was just a 14-year-old twerp, you know, and it was just fun. Everything was different. I remember, of course, different pop and different candy, and you could gamble in the hotel lobbies. It was just a wonderland for a little kid. And we went to this, there's so much history around us. And we'd go to these family-run piano factories, the Grotrian Steinweg factory in Braunschweig, the German Steinway, of course, you know. And we went to a monastery in Vienna where they made the Bösendorfer pianos, a former monastery. Bösendorfer is the most luxurious and expensive piano in the world. They brag that Yamaha makes as many pianos in a month that Bösendorfer's made in 100 years.
Wow. You know?
And,
wow.
And there's no conveyor belt. You're not mass producing pianos. Each piano, it occurred to me, even as a 14-year-old going to that monastery, was birthed in its own cell, a former monk's cell. And they had these craftsmen tuning up the wood on the hammer shanks and softening the felt that was just from the right wool, from the right sheep, and all these loving things they put into the pianos. And the interesting thing is my dad knew the personality of his customers that whose pianos he tuned in Seattle. And they were spending a lot of money. And my dad would go over to Vienna and I would go with him and I would play the pianos. They'd line up 5 or 6 of these big shiny black grands, you know, and I would play each one because each one had a different personality. Because it was handmade. It was like children. And my dad would analyze the sound and he would sign the sounding board of the piano that matched his customer's musical taste. They'd put it in a box and send it back to Seattle. And that was my first trip to Europe, was to go to the factory and play those amazing pianos. And it was just a beautiful experience. And it helped me fall in love with Europe in so many ways. The craftsmanship, the passion people have for their calling when they find their niche, the love of culture, the fact that people do what they do, not because that's what everybody else will think is success or what gets the most esteem or the most money, but that's what they really are here on this planet to do. I just love that. And we saw that in the piano factories in Germany and in Austria.
Really kind of, it's like that idea, living to work or working to live.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. And in Europe, they just know how to live. And we saw that in the factories. We'd go to the factories and then we would go out and have dinner and go on a hike or something with the people that were selling pianos one day and embracing life the next. And, you know, we do that too, but it's an inspiration in Europe. My piano is from the Black Forest. It's a Sauter. I have 2 Sauter grand pianos and I bought my Sauter piano before I even had a car. I was 16 years old, I think. Yeah. It was a big investment for me. My dad gave me a discount because the lid was sun damaged, so it was a little bit faded. And I was teaching piano on that, and I have that piano to this very day. My dad would always say, you know, when you buy a piano, it's a lifetime investment. And it certainly is, because I bought that piano 50 years ago, and I still have it, and I still love it.
Plus, they're really hard to move, so you're stuck with it.
You're stuck with it, yeah.
You still play the piano. What kind of music do you enjoy playing? And when do you, first of all, maybe... when do you get the opportunity to play the piano? When are you drawn to playing?
Well, I'm such a workaholic with my work. I love my work, and it's travel writing. And so I'm doing a lot of TV production, radio production, writing guidebooks, and so on. And I've got a company with 100 people on our payroll. We're having a tough year this year with COVID. So it's we're sort of in crisis that way. But we're keeping our team together because we know we will be throttling up as soon as we get through this COVID thing. And people are going to want to get back to Europe. And we're going to be there ready to go. But I play the piano just to relax. I play the piano according to my mood. I think I would play the piano as a refuge when I've ever had difficult times. If I'm having difficulty with my partner or something like that, I'll just go play the piano. It takes me somewhere else. I play the piano. I like to play the piano late at night in the dark. I just like to see where I like to improvise and with the blues scale and so on. And I like to travel. And for me, sitting down at the keyboard is kind of like traveling. Mm-hmm. I've got this 3-ring notebook that I've had ever since I was a college student, and I collect, it's got my whole repertoire. And I haven't really learned any serious songs since I was in my 20s, but I just treasure those songs that I do know how to play. And if you haven't played a song for a few years, it gets rusty, and it's always very rewarding to dust it off and realize, oh, it's still there in my fingers. I can play it, but it just takes a few minutes to dust it off. So it's my little refuge. And if I had a different life, if I was not working so hard, I'd play a lot more. But I don't feel comfortable in a house without a piano. I need to have a keyboard nearby. It's kind of my little comfort blankie.
I'd love to play some music right now. Is there a song from that 3-ring notebook that that we could find and play on the show?
Ooh, I just love Scarlatti. Any sonata by Scarlatti or a bourrée by Scarlatti. It's fun on a harpsichord, and it's great on a piano.
Beautiful. Thank you. World Cafe, a song that my guest today, Rick Steves, enjoys playing on the piano. Rick is telling us some of his music-related travel stories today. You can find some of them in his new book, For the Love of Europe. The piano and the organ are very different instruments, but there are some similarities. And you got to see a pretty incredible pipe organ in Paris, the pipe organ at the Church of Saint-Sulpice. Could you describe this pipe organ for us?
This is one of the most beautiful musical experiences. And I don't think they're letting people do this anymore during COVID, but I hope and pray they open up this tradition again. But at the great Cathedral of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, between the masses on Sunday morning, they play a little concert. And music lovers in the know stand in the back of the nave, and there's a little green door, and it opens up. And you feel so privileged. And it's a tight spiral staircase. And like little 16th notes, you scamper up these spiral stairs to the very top. You get to the organ loft. And then you see tacked on the wall the list of all the organists who've warmed that bench. And Dupré and Vidor and today Daniel Roth. And it goes all the way back. I mean, it goes back theoretically to Bach. I mean, that's where all these organ lovers go back to. And you gather around Daniel Roth, surrounded by all these pipes. And he's got like four keyboards and his feet are going crazy on the pedals. And he's got an assistant that pulls and pushes all the stops and keeps track of all the music. And he's got a funky little mirror that hangs there so he can look down and see the priest and he can be in sync with the mass. And to be up there and to witness that, you just can't believe. You're sitting there leaning on the organ, looking over at Daniel Roth. And it's just because you knew that the little door would open after the first mass. I love it. I just love it.
We're going to hear a performance now of Daniel Roth playing that Saint-Sulpice grand organ in Paris. Here it is. What you just heard is music from the Saint-Sulpice Grand Organ in Paris, played by the current organist Daniel Roth. You can read all about Rick Steves' visit to see that pipe organ in person in his latest book, For the Love of Europe. We're traveling with Rick Steves today on the World Cafe. Right now, we're in Paris. One thing I noticed when I went to Paris was that I heard a lot of American and Canadian music. I remember being at a bistro near the Louvre, which admittedly was pretty touristy, and they were playing Nickelback on the stereo. And I was like, this is not how I dreamed this. I know that you seek out, you know, traditional music when you're traveling, but how have you experienced the influence of North American music in Europe?
Well, it's certainly a lot of a love of jazz and swing music and so on. And in Paris, if you can go to these jazz clubs, they're so, you know, what I like about jazz clubs in Paris is they're kind of down home. Paris can be a little bit imposing or a little bit, you know, make you feel like you're not very with it or sophisticated because they're so confident and they're so cultured. But they're just like we are, and they get together with their friends and they go down into a cellar and they love to do the jitterbug and the swing and to be there at the in an old cellar that has a couple of hundred years of history, and to hear the jazz really live and really being consumed voraciously by music lovers who are living in that neighborhood. That's a beautiful experience. The famous one that's so accessible is right in the Latin Quarter. It's called the Caveau de la Huche or Hache. And, you know, I'm surprised it's not more touristy. All the guidebooks write about it. I've been going there for years. And every time I go in, I just think, this is great. What a nice experience. You know, Europeans love American music, American culture. And the jazz is a big hit in Europe.
Speaking of American culture, I know I did read in the New York Times profile of you, which was wonderful, that you spent a lot of time analyzing the 1968 Billboard pop charts when you were a teenager, and you tracked the trajectories of bands like Creedence Clearwater Revival and Elvis and the Beatles. Could you explain your tracking system for us? How did that analysis work?
It's so funny because that was when I was 13 or 14 years old, before I'd even been to Europe. And I was really into every week, you know, they had the top top 20 or the top 40. And I would cut it out. Every Tuesday it came out in the Seattle Times and I would cut it out. And I've got this scrapbook to this day. In fact, I just got it out the other day because I'm going to get it scanned because it's the tape, the Scotch tape is 50 years old now. And, but every week for 3 or 4 years, I would tape this into my scrapbook. And then I had a system where I would add up the points. You'd get 20 points for a number one, 19 points for a number two song and 10 points for a number 10, and you'd get 1 point for a number 20 song. And then every month or every quarter or something, I would add it up and I would see which groups are making the most points, and I would chart it on a graph. So you could have, you could have Creedence Clearwater, and then you could have the Jackson Five, and here comes Neil Diamond. And then where are the Beatles? Oh, Beatles are Beatles, Beatles. And then, oh, the Monkees. No, the Monkees are ahead of the Beatles. That can't be. And then the Beatles come up with Hey Jude, and wham, they go right off the top of the chart. I noticed one of my charts had the Beatles. This must have been 1969 or 70 when they were breaking up. So it had the Beatles, who were right there with Creedence and the Stones and the Monkees. But then I said, it's not fair just to have the Beatles alone, because you had John Lennon and Paul McCartney and George Harrison all doing singles on right. their own. So I had another line on the chart, which was the Beatles together and as individuals all together. And they were like double anybody else on the chart. So when I look at that, I just think, who was this kid, this little 13-year-old? My penmanship was perfect. It was so diligent. I can't even read my writing now. But I think I was, and this is what Sam Anderson, the New York Times magazine writer that did that interview. Sam pointed out that I had that attention to detail that you need, and that passion for sharing stuff with other people that you need to be a good travel writer. And I just took all of that, and I, just like I quit teaching piano and I started to teach travel, I just shifted it over, and I moved into travel writing.
Now, are you still, when it comes to contemporary music, are you still a classic rock guy? What do you reach for when you want to listen to something new?
I'm hopeless. I'm so out of it. To me, I hesitate to even say what I think is cutting edge. I'm 70s and 80s. That's if I go to Spotify and want to dream up some cool playlist, it's this or that in the 70s and 80s.
What's your favorite Beatles track? We'll throw one on right now.
Oh, Hello, Goodbye.
Let's do it. I say hi, you say no, you say why, and I say I don't know. Oh no, you say goodbye, and I say hello. Hello, Goodbye from the Beatles. That song was chosen by my guest today, Rick Steves. Rick is taking us on a musical tour of Europe right now, and our next stop is Ireland. You take us to the town of Dingle in Ireland. What can you tell us about Dingle?
Well, Dingle is it's the classic, what I call a backdoor. It's the far southwest tip of Ireland, where they stand on the bluff and they gaze out of the Atlantic and they say, the next parish over is Boston. And it is this humble, very traditional fishing town that loves beer and loves music and loves crack. And crack means conversation in the pubs, you see. And you've got this tiny population with a huge number of pubs. And at night, most of the pubs have live music. And it's just a big square route around the town. And there must be 7 pubs with live music. And it's all free. You just buy a beer and you listen to the music and enjoy the scene. In pubs, they say, I love the thought that they really like to say, strangers are just friends who've yet to meet, And you go to a pub in Ireland and you feel exactly that.
Is there, can you recall a favorite Irish folk song that you've heard in a pub that we could play?
I can't recall. I wouldn't say I've got a favorite, but I just love it when they're stomping on the ground in a way that you think it's shaking the paint off the floor. And the waitstaff is running around with frothy, big pint glasses that are stacked like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. You don't know how they're not going to fall. And I don't care what the song is, when you have that driving rhythm and that beautiful sort of ambience created, go ahead, Raina, pick
you,
a song.
You just reminded me with that description of a song that I know that will fit perfectly.
It's called
The Rattlin' Bog. It's an Irish folk song. It gets faster and faster every verse. You can completely imagine people spilling beer on the table as they try to keep up with it.
I love it. Let's hear it.
Let's do that. It's The Rattlin' Bog on World Cafe.
On that branch there was a twig, rare twig and a rattling twig. The twig on the branch and the branch on the limb, and the limb on the bough, and the bough on the tree, and the tree in the hole, and the hole in the bog, and the bog down in the valley, oh. Oh, the rattling bog and the bog down in the valley, oh. Rare bog and a rattling bog and the bog down in the valley, oh. On that twig there was a leaf, rare leaf and a rattling leaf. The leaf on the twig and the twig on the branch and the branch on the limb and the limb on the bough and the bough on the tree and the tree in the hole and the hole in the bog down in the valley.
You are listening to The World Cafe. That was The Rattlin' Bog, an Irish folk song. We are traveling the world and listening to music with Rick Steves today. His latest book, For the Love of Europe, features 100 of his own travel memories. A lot of them have to do with music. The last place that we're going to visit today is Vienna. And a lot of the music we've talked about today is folk music or music that's woven into the culture of a place and the people. But Vienna's a little bit different because, like you say in the book, it was a mecca for classical composers in the 17th and 18th century. So people like Mozart and Beethoven. When you go to Vienna now, how obvious is that influence of the musical history the place has?
You know, when I go to, it's interesting you ask that, Raina, because last time I was in Vienna, and I love going to Vienna to update my guidebook. I've got a personal passion for my, and love of my chapter on Vienna, and I just want to make it a really good part of it. This city really cares about music, and not just music for fancy people and people who can afford the box seats and so on, but it makes room for people that are struggling, people who are students, people that are retirees that love music and don't have a lot of money. At the opera, you can, of course, get a nice seat at the opera, but there's always several hundred standing room seats available for like $5. And all you got to do is line up at the afternoon at a certain time, the day of the show, and they've got it. They love their opera so much. I think there's 300 performances a year, but every night of the week is a different performance. And they have to change out all the stage sets and so on. So it's a lot of work. But it is designed for the local people to get their musical fix. Now, when I left the hotel, I saw at the Opera House something that was new. They had chairs set up, and they had a big giant screen streaming the live performance of what was going on inside. And people were, going to the opera for free by sitting outside and watching it being projected on the wall. And then I walked around the Ringstrasse a little farther away toward the city hall, the Rathaus, and it set up in front of the Rathaus in the summer, they have this festival where they've got the biggest screen I've ever seen, and they do famous concerts, and it's a food circus. So there's all of these, there must be 40 different food tents set up. And I talked to the person at the tourist information office about this, and they said the city has money to help younger people gain an appreciation for classical music. They know that the music festival at the city hall in Vienna, the outdoor free music festival, is just considered a meat market by the young people. It's the best place to pick up a nice partner because it's, you know, it's just a fun, classy place to go for certain people to find the good partner. So they say, we're just celebrating the fact that this is more of a meat market than a music festival, but it all works together. And we're going to let people know that classical music is worth paying attention to. So you go there and it's just thriving with young people, and 1,000 people sit down and watch the concert. And it's a beautiful moment. And you just think Vienna really gets it.
I like that idea that Vienna is making classical music sexy again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for the tourist, you know, there's two dimensions. You go there and you become a temporary local enjoying concerts. And then you also remember from a sightseeing point of view, you could fill several days with sightseeing. There's a whole wing of the Hofburg Palace, which is a music museum. And I was just looking at one of the clips on my from my TV show where I got to go in there and play how the sort of evolution of the piano from the clavichord to the harpsichord to the pianoforte. And I got to play it and demonstrate how the quill plucks the string, and then how the piano through the hammer, so you can have it going soft and loud. In fact, let's call it the soft loud, the pianoforte. Well, let's just shorten it to piano. I got to demonstrate that. That was really fun. But that's a great museum. There's another museum called the House of Music, where you can actually pick up a baton and direct a big giant screen of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
I've done it many times. And you'd go faster, you go slower, you do a little rubato. And if you screw up, they put down their violins and they laugh at you. So it's that's just a lot of fun. It's very interactive. So that's a fun museum. And then, of course, whatever composer you're excited about who had a Viennese heritage, you can go to that composer's home and see a museum about that particular musical genius.
Well, since we are in Vienna right now, who's a Viennese composer or composer who had time in Vienna that you're excited about?
Oh, you know, I'm inclined to say Mozart or Beethoven, but I'm a sucker for Strauss and the waltzes. And I just... every time I get to see the Strauss waltzes with people dancing in Vienna. And there's a whole culture of people that go to Vienna just to put on fancy ball gowns and go to these fancy Strauss waltz festivals. Let's have a Strauss waltz.
The Strauss Waltz on World Cafe, chosen by my guest today, Rick Steves. Rick Steves has taken us on a musical tour of Europe today with stories from his latest book, For the Love of Europe. You can find that book. It is out now. There are so many parts in this book where you seem to find yourself surrounded by music, where you've almost stumbled into it. My own favorite music-related travel memory, it's kind of the same deal. My partner and I were in Munich. There happened to be a spring festival happening. There was this giant tent called the Hippodrome. There were hundreds of young people in Lederhosen inside, dancing on the tables with beer steins. And neither my partner or I speak German. But before you know it, we're on the table, we're singing, we're holding up our beer, having this great time. And to me, that's really the beauty of traveling and of music, like the connection it allows you to create with other people. For you, Rick, what have your encounters and experiences with music in your travels taught you about people?
When I travel, it connects me with history. It also reminds me the world is filled with beautiful people. They say music is the international language. Yes, music is the international language. You can go to the opera in Milan. You can go to the Busker Festival in Bern. You can go to the home of Edvard Grieg on the fjords in Norway. You can hear a tuna band, one of those troubadour bands in Salamanca in Spain. And it's all people celebrating life in their own culture. It can be today, it can be from the distant past, it can be in a language you don't understand, but music weaves it together. And that's a pretty poignant thing to be able to experience. It's one of the great intangible joys of travel. And I really feel bad for somebody who travels that doesn't recognize that music is an integral part of the travel experience. And it takes a little doing. But I would highly recommend, as you plan your trip and prepare for your trip and as you do your trip, to spice in a good dose of music.
Rick Steves, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
I've enjoyed every minute, Raina. I'm just these thoughts have made me want to go back to Europe and enjoy some music.
Me too. I'm Raina Duras, back in a moment with more World Cafe.